Berg is next. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and I'm really grateful for the time that is being given to the Morning Show by Carlo Nivicosi, who is Deputy Director of the Walworth County Department of Health and Human Services. And Carlo Nivicosi and his colleagues are keeping close watch over the situation involving COVID-19 and the ongoing pandemic and this fall surge that we had heard so much about and seems to be with us in full force. And he's taking a few minutes to join us on today's morning show. And Carlo Nivicosi, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Right, thank you. Thank you for having me again. I appreciate the time.
You were mentioning before we went on the air that it's a little bit jarring to come back to work after having been away for a few days for the Thanksgiving holiday. So for someone in your line of work, and especially at this point in time, what does a Monday morning after a long holiday break look like?
Well, there's a fair amount of catch-up to do. I'm sorry about that overhead page.
No problem.
I think you mentioned that you used the word surge, and that is certainly apt at this point. We don't do our own modeling. We depend on other models to kind of give us some projection, some sense of where this thing is going, and we continue to be surprised at the exponential growth in cases that we've seen in Walworth County specifically. I guess I was hoping, you know, we'd come back after the Thanksgiving holiday and things would have completely resolved. I think that's a little unrealistic, but so here we are. We are still in the middle of a surge. I can't really say if we've peaked. I suppose we'll know in a week or two as we start to assess the full impact of the holidays.
When I looked at the most recent, I think you're calling them snapshots, that are posted to the public every Thursday, and the most recent snapshot that I looked at showed 511 active COVID cases in Walworth County and a total number of cases of over 5,700. Does it sound like I'm remembering the numbers correctly?
You are spot on. As of this moment, that's the number that we have. We're still tabulating our numbers from the weekend to see what came in, but we'll have those out for everyone shortly, and we'll be back to updating daily again.
Right. I wish I had taken the time to, it just didn't occur to me in the moment, but to look at the snapshots right before that. I am assuming that we are talking about escalating numbers and that the snapshot before that and the snapshot before that would not have been quite as high as 511, or am I making a mistake?
5'11", I think we've been a little bit over 5'11", but really this is about as high as it's been at any point, you know, give or take a few, as high as it's been during the pandemic. I don't expect when today's numbers come in for anything significant for any significant improvements in that number. I will say, you know, last week and the week before, we really started to grow more concerned with kind of the state of our healthcare system. Our hospitalizations had also been up at really the highest levels that we'd seen. Really, one of the things we were pleased with up until that point was that our hospital data had continued to look pretty good. You know, anywhere from 2 to 6 people in the hospital at any given point for COVID-related symptoms. And last week and the week before that, I think we hit 14. Where it's good to see, even though our number of active cases is as high as it is, we're back down to 6 in the hospital as of right now.
In terms of this fall surge, has it turned out to be as serious a surge as had been maybe projected by COVID experts back in the summer when we began talking about this in such dire terms? I mean, has reality played out about as expectations were?
I think it has. It is as advertised. Again, I think just looking at 500 active cases, Walworth County is not that big. And those are only, you know, laboratory confirmed positives. You know, the people that are getting tested continue to be those that are in the working, kind of the working age population. That's who gets out and gets tested. So we know that there are kids out there who are positive and they're just probable positives. They're not lab confirmed. We've got people who, so there are plenty of people out there that we don't have that lab confirmed number. So it is widespread.
Building on that, when you look at Walworth County and you see 511 cases, is there anything that you can tell us in terms of where these cases are predominantly springing up? Or as you just said, is it just kind of everywhere? I mean,
it is everywhere. I looked at that before we talked, trying to get some, some read on what the data was telling us. And it is, like I said, the increased cases are not happening in any one particular, one particular age group. We're seeing increases across the board, and just having increased cases in and of itself is not, it's not something to be overly concerned with. It's when we've started seeing now the past few weeks this increased strain on our healthcare system, the system as a whole. I'm talking hospital staff, long-term care facilities, where many of those workers may not be high risk for COVID themselves, but if they're out for 14 days at a time, we're starting to see staffing shortages at our hospitals and the long-term care centers. That's got an impact on the healthcare system's ability to take care of the people that need it. And we've also seen, again, really looking at about the past 2 weeks, it seems like to some extent COVID has made its way back into some of our long-term care centers. That's what this is all about, is what we really need to do is make sure that those people are protected. And we've had some increased deaths in long-term care centers. We had a pretty good stretch the summer and the fall where we largely avoided that. We saw things like the surge in cases related to UW-Whitewater coming on campus, which was sensational. However, that group, relatively low risk for negative COVID outcomes. We've seen that shift a little bit, and I think this is the time to really remind everybody why we're doing this, and that many people who are this group of 500 plus that are lab positive right now may be relatively low risk for death, but it's about making sure those long-term care facilities are safe, those people aren't contracting COVID, aren't getting it from staff, and that we've got enough doctors and nurses to staff our hospitals for the people that need it.
That really is kind of a frightening scenario. And of course, it's a scenario that, as far as I know, none of us have ever seen in our lifetimes. No. We've mentioned Thanksgiving a couple of times already. I noticed that on the Walworth County website, and I'm sure this was on similar websites in other counties and in other states for that matter, suggestions on how to have a safe Thanksgiving gathering with a lot of basic things like keep the numbers small and keep your distance from people not in your household and wear masks and so on. And we certainly hope that people were mindful of those suggestions, and that people were celebrating in safe fashion. In terms of a potential post-Thanksgiving surge, when typically would we see those kind of numbers? I mean, at what point are you going to be especially watching for an uptick in numbers that would very likely be tied to the Thanksgiving holiday?
Next week. So we're seeing symptoms emerge, you know, 3 to 5 days after exposure. But we're still using that 14-day kind of, you've got this 14-day period from exposure when, you know, it may take some extra time for the virus to incubate. So I think next week is really when we'll know how we did. I've heard a lot of stories about families really dialing things back. And you're right, the suggestions are concrete. There wasn't anything groundbreaking in our suggestions. Distance still is your best friend when it comes to limiting COVID spread. I do think it was probably realistic to ask people to dial things back rather than to say, don't travel, don't do it. I think that may also have set us up for failure, but we'll know by next week how we did. Accompanying that guidance, we've had a lot of contact with our schools. That's one of the things too I think we're most proud of, is that the majority of Walworth County public schools have been face to face for much of the school year. And with this surge was the first time that we made any sort of recommendation for them to evaluate that practice. And we had asked the schools to consider extending the Thanksgiving break 1 or 2 weeks beyond the holiday. I think some schools have elected to, others haven't. You know, we made that recommendation, acknowledging that our schools have done such a nice job and we haven't seen a lot of spread in the schools. So it was, you know, kind of our way of trying to balance both the community's needs as it relates to staffing shortages at the long-term care facilities and the hospitals, with knowing what value having face-to-face school provides to the community. And so that's where we landed on asking schools to consider a 1 or a 2 week pause in face-to-face education. Although because we haven't seen widespread transmission in the schools, we allowed them to make those decisions on their own with their school boards about whether or not to continue face-to-face. We're looking right now, continue to see really encouraging research about how you can have school, face-to-face school safely, even when you've got high rates of transmission. So we're going to continue to work with them to make sure that the strategies that they've got in place are appropriate for the amount of spread we're seeing in the community.
It's great to hear some good news for a change in terms of COVID-19. Can we just veer for a second to the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, which of course is under your purview, being located in Walworth County? I think we've mentioned them once already in the course of this conversation. How would you summarize how UW-Whitewater has done? I know in at least one of our previous conversations, we talked about how college-age students, generally speaking, are not the easiest population to wrangle when it comes to cautious, careful behavior.
September was bad. It's been much less a story since September. October and November have been relatively quiet. The university's taken a lot of responsibility for testing their students, really handling things on campus in terms of testing, contact tracing, limiting the amount of activities that are happening. And right now, they are UW-Whitewater as planned. They had planned this back in, I think July or August. They are now virtual for the rest of this semester. So I believe there are still some students on campus, but classes are all remote at this point. So I'm, again, another silver lining, another thing to be encouraged by is how much better things have gone on campus really since September.
After a dispiriting beginning of the fall semester.
The reason that was such a big deal was that was the same time schools were deciding whether or not to have face-to-face learning for school-aged kids, and with how that really impacted our county's positivity rate, we had to pivot with our schools and get them some better data to make some decisions on, again, how they could, even with what was happening on the UW-Whitewater campus, how they could get younger kids, get them into seats, into the desks.
Right. I wanted to be sure to ask you about the important matter of contact tracing and the way in which maybe some of the challenges of that are shifting as this fall surge worsens. First of all, I don't think there are too many listeners who have absolutely no acquaintance whatsoever with contact tracing, but I think it would be helpful for you to just spell out what is supposed to happen in contact tracing, what the purpose of it is, and maybe just one or two basics about how it tends to be done. And then let's talk about this moment in time and how challenging it is to do effective contact tracing.
Oh, there are a few pieces to contact tracing. The first is really the disease investigation phase. That entails notifying the person who's got a positive result. Sometimes people hear from their physicians, depending on where they get their tests. They may hear before public health does, but more often than not, we're the ones that are reaching out and contacting people when they have a lab confirmed positive. Really for almost the entire duration of the pandemic, we'd been able to contact nearly everyone within 24 hours of getting that positive notification. Really the benchmark is 48 hours. You want to get a hold of somebody within 48 hours, let them know they're positive, tell them how to quarantine, tell them how to isolate. You know, the next piece of that is really identifying everyone that's been in close contact with that lab confirmed person. This is an interview, and it's lengthy. These things can take, you know, more than an hour to do a really good interview, gather contact information. And then in, you know, kind of in the perfect public health world, that public health worker would then reach out to all of those people that have been close contacts, provide them with support, provide them with instructions, and provide them with guidance, you know, tell them what to do if they're not feeling well. And ultimately then, public health would have the capacity to do follow-up calls with these people to check in on them, see how they're doing, see how they're tolerating their quarantine or their isolation. We've moved to really our crisis standards of contact tracing, which means, like, you know, our neighboring counties, Jefferson, Rock, you know, we've been completely overwhelmed. Our ability to contact people timely and to do these full best practice contact investigations, our capacity, we don't have the capacity to do it. In spite of earnest efforts to bring new staff in, it's not very appealing work. It's a hard job, and so finding people that want to do it is a challenge. And so what we do now is we prioritize our disease investigations to people that are in those higher risk groups. So we're using our resources to do the contact investigations, the disease investigations for people that are 60 or older or under 18. And really we're following our outbreak, you know, our outbreak management, those resources are focused on following up with long-term care centers and schools. And when it comes to people that are in those lower risk groups, we're still calling them and letting them know, obviously, of their positive results, but we're asking them to help with the contact tracing efforts, to asking them to notify their close contacts. And we're not doing it again, unless these are people falling into some higher risk categories.
Hmm. And I suspect that Walworth County is by no means alone in finding itself in this predicament in terms of contact tracing being all but impossible to do in the way that you were doing it a few months ago.
It's challenging. And there's the COVID fatigue. I think you hear people talk about too. Even when we were able to do more of the contact tracing prior to this surge, we were finding people less and less likely, less and less interested in talking to us. You know, not wanting to have the conversation with public health about quarantine or isolation. And so, you know, we understand. It's frustrating though, you know, when it's our job. We're just trying to do the best we can to protect the health of the public.
Hmm. And I hadn't thought about that, but I'm sure it is difficult to find people who are willing to undertake what can be a really thankless and difficult kind of work. It's almost like trying to hire people to be telemarketers, and I don't know too many people who would go out of their way to do that kind of work. And in some ways, this is sort of that same dynamic, and it's about making telephone calls to people who are likely to not welcome those calls.
Right. And it requires a fair amount of training, too. It's not the kind of job where you can just pluck somebody off the streets and drop them into a desk and have them start making these phone calls. This is highly sensitive, protected health information they're dealing with. And the people that do this work have access to, you know, the state's public health database. We need to make sure the people we're choosing to do this are skilled and trustworthy and can have these difficult kinds of conversations with people who really might not be all that interested in talking with them. So that's been part of the challenge too. We found it takes about 3 weeks to adequately train someone and to be really good at this work. We've struggled to find people that are willing to stick around that long to do it.
A last question. Since we last talked, of course, there has been this tremendously exciting and encouraging news about vaccines and more than one. And of course, they are not at the moment available to the general public, of course, but it is thrilling to know that there are such promising results from several different companies, and that this is something that we are very likely to see, of course, at some point in the not terribly distant future. How concerned are you about this encouraging news affecting people's behavior in terms of their caution at this present moment, when there's still not a vaccine readily and immediately available?
Sure. This is still the circle back to the theme of this discussion, I think, which is really we're doing this because we've got some people out there that are incredibly vulnerable. This disease is devastating to and we know who it impacts. Again, this is not news. This is not a secret. I certainly can see how this hope that a vaccine is coming would allow people to, maybe run and dance in the streets and celebrate. What we don't know is how it's going to roll out, who's going to get it first. It could be, while it's coming, it could be months. We could be well into 2021 before the general population, the lower risk population, has access to this. I don't know that. That's just what I suspect. Which means that millions and millions of people are still going to present a high risk to those that are not yet vaccinated. So it's maybe, if anything, a reminder to just hang on a little bit longer. There's hope. Help is on the way. We're nearing the end of this. I still believe, though, that 2021 is going to be shaped by COVID one way or another. We're going to continue to deal with this through much of 2021.
Carlo Nevicozzi, I appreciate you making time during what I know is a very busy day for you. Thank you for the information that you have provided. Thank you for the good work that you and your colleagues are doing on this very, very important issue. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to get to part two of today's program in just a moment. First, we want to remind you about the fundraiser going on right now with Wisconsin Public Radio. WGTD, of course, is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio, and their well-being is our well-being. So your support for Wisconsin Public Radio is the best way that you can support the work that we do here at WGTD, serving the listening audience of southeastern Wisconsin. It's very, very simple. You can go to their website, which is wpr.org, or you can call toll-free. And that phone number is 1-888-202-2552. Again, 1-888-202-2552. Or you can go to WPR.org. And we appreciate your support of Wisconsin Public Radio and WGTD. Part two of today's morning show is coming up in just a moment. In this portion of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be talking about the remarkable story of Hope O. Baker and the book that she has written called Finding Hope, A Birth Mother's Journey into the Light. Hope O. Baker became unexpectedly pregnant at the age of 21, and she made the difficult decision of deciding to give her child up for adoption, and in the framework of an open adoption. And although there have been difficulties along the way, it is ultimately a tremendously uplifting and inspiring story, and she shares it in this book, Finding Hope, published by Lioncrest. Hope O. Baker, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg. I'm so excited to be here.
Glad we can have this conversation. So let's get right to the heart of the matter, the fact of this unexpected pregnancy when you were 21 years old. As you describe this experience of getting this unanticipated news, and particularly when it comes to you know, your thoughts, you thought about a number of different possibilities, including the possibility of abortion. You went so far as to travel all the way to Kansas City, and once you reached there, decided against it. Just tell us a little bit about that journey, both the geographical and, in a sense, the emotional journey that you took at this point before your baby had even been born.
You know, I think that when I look back to those times, I knew I wasn't ready to be a mom, and I just, you know, it was a worrisome thing as a 21-year-old college student, not sure what to do. And, you know, I am pro-choice, very pro-choice, but when it came down to it, and I was sitting there, and they're describing, you know, what was going to happen, I just, in that moment, decided that, you know, my son had to be born. And I didn't actually know he was a boy at that time, but I called him my son. I think I intuitively knew. So here we are, you know, 7 years later, and I'm glad that I made that choice.
Mm. You found out that you were pregnant. You found out that you were pregnant at 20 weeks, and I'm not sure, is that unusually late? I'm sort of guessing that it probably is unusually late to learn that news. To what extent was that kind of a complicating factor in terms of deciding what you were going to do about this pregnancy?
Yeah, I'll tell you. When I found out, I just remember asking over and over again, what are my options? What are my options? I didn't know how far along I was at that moment. And I, you know, it's terrible that it happened this way, but my mom, the day after I got pregnant, she told me that she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And so I just spent those months so distracted and trying to take care of her. And, you know, I actually went to the doctor 2 times and said, there's something wrong with me. You know, something doesn't feel right. And I was referred to a psychologist because they attributed to my mom's sickness and that I was having, you know, I was having emotional problems with that. But here all along, I was pregnant. I should have just taken a pregnancy test. I just, you know, looking back now, it just seems so obvious. But, you know, 20 weeks is further along. I mean, people typically find out before that, but there are people who find out later. And, you know, I think that I can sit here now and say, oh, I wish I would have thought out sooner. But had I thought out sooner, I might have made a different choice about bringing my son into this world, you know, had it been not so late. So I think everything happens in mysterious ways, you know?
One of the interesting things about the story is that when you are at the hospital and about to give birth, and even in the aftermath of having given birth, you were really pressured when you were at the hospital and told that you were pregnant, it's really kind of remarkable how much pressure you were put under by people at the hospital. I mean, people on the staff at the hospital, in terms of what you should do with this pregnancy. And to a person, you were counseled to have the baby and give it up for adoption, and that there was even somebody there at the hospital on the staff who was willing to adopt the baby. Looking back, does that strike you as kind of remarkable, the way in which you were pressured to make a particular decision? And did it feel strange in the moment?
You know, I will never forget those moments of sitting there, just finding out I was pregnant. I was by myself. My mom wasn't there yet. And they're telling me that there's a woman in the hospital waiting to meet me. And they used this phrase. They said, no matter the health problems or deformities, because they thought, oh, I'm a college kid. I had been drinking all the time. Because my mom had been diagnosed with cancer, I wasn't, which was a blessing in disguise. But, you know, they're wanting me to meet this woman right then and there, 5 minutes after I found out I was pregnant. You know, it was just insanity. And you know, I even wrote the clinical letter. I wrote a letter and I said, I hope that no other woman has to go through what you put me through. And I wasn't ready to look at the ultrasound picture. And the ultrasound nurse forced me to look at it, literally. And I just wasn't ready, and I needed to process. And it was very uncomfortable. And it just, you know, I get it. I think it was a faith-based clinic in Alexandria, Minnesota. My gosh, I really hope that no woman, I did write a strong word letter, like, please don't do this to another person. It was traumatizing enough going through this, and I needed to process. I didn't meet a woman who was going to adopt my child. I didn't even know anything about adoption at that point.
Hmm. One powerful and painful moment in your story is when your mother, with whom you have sometimes had a difficult relationship, said to you very forthrightly, Hope, you can't do this. You won't be a good mother. Tell us about the moment that you heard those words and what kind of difference those words made to you in all of this.
It took me a long time to forgive my mother for saying that. And when I look back, hearing those words changed everything for me. And, you know, I spent the better part of 5 years blaming my mom, being so angry for what she said. And now that I look back, I realize that, you know, my mom had my older sister very young. And she wanted me to be able to have, you know, a fighting chance in life. I get where she was coming from now, but let me tell you, it took a long time to be able to look her in her eyes and not be angry at her and not be mad and not blame her. But at the end of the day, I know that her words came out harsh, but I understand where they came from now. And I think that that's really helped us, you know, move past it.
You did, of course, make the decision to go through with having the baby, but choosing to give it up for adoption. One of the things you say about that moment where you give birth to a baby but then choose not to keep it is that one thing you felt like was an empty vessel. I thought that was such an interesting choice of words. Tell us more about that feeling of being reduced, in a sense, to an empty vessel.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up, because I was just reading that part of my book over again for National Adoption Awareness Month, and sharing that, literally that same line. I think in adoption, people want to share how beautiful it is and how wonderful it is. And it's not that it's not beautiful and wonderful. You know, people want to be parents and they can't. So there's, you know, this is how they build their family. And I do think adoption can be beautiful. But I think that a lot of times we forget about the pain and the trauma of adoption. I mean, in order for my son's mom to take him home, I had to lose him. I had to sign a piece of paper that said that I was no longer his mom, right? I had to do that. And I think that when you're in this position as an expectant mom, and people just want babies. And not just my son's mom, you know, she was very kind and caring and loving, but you get so desperate because you want a baby so bad. And I get it. I totally get it. But it leaves a lot of room for, you know, just people feeling empty and people feeling like, this is why I'm here. This person loves me because there's a baby inside me, right? Like they want my child. And when you come to that realization and realize that there's this whole industry that is rooting for you to not parent your child, like that is their goal. Their goal is for an expectant mom to not raise their child. And I think that that is a very empty feeling. And it makes, you know, it makes you feel like a vessel. And like, you know, there weren't people advocating for me in the adoption world to raise my son and, you know, helping me find solutions and options. Like, I didn't have that. Never was that a thing. It was always, okay, what can we do now? You made this choice. Now, how do we get this baby from you? That's how the adoption industry works.
At least certainly as you experienced it. You chose something called open adoption. Explain to our listeners what open adoption is.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because I met somebody yesterday who's an adoptee. And when she was telling me her story, she was telling me that her adoption, she's 40 years old. Her adoption started as open, and then the adopted parents closed it after 1 year of her life. And she just got in contact with her birth mother. Her birth mother just found her. After 40 years, she found her. And it's, you know, I'm lucky in my situation because in California, if I request an attorney, the hopeful adopted parent has to provide that for the expectant mom who will become a birth mom. They have to provide that. So when you look at open adoption, I mean, I get pictures of my son. I get to see him. You know, in our contract, it says 2 to 3 times a year. My son, you know, if he wants to FaceTime me, he can call me whenever he wants. My son's mom actually sends me picture books. Like, this is just something she does. She doesn't legally have to do it, but she sends my mom, my grandma, and myself picture books. It's just everyday life, just, you know, full of pictures of my son, which is incredible. But, you know, when you look at open and closed adoption, I mean, closed is there's no relationship, there's no picture, there is nothing. The child might not even know his birth mom's name. They may never know that, you know, and that's how a lot of adoptions used to be done. They were closed. That was just the normal standard. And now you don't see as many closed adoptions. Like, closed adoptions happen with international adoption, but domestic adoptions, it's becoming less common, which is how it should be. I mean, I know that with my open adoption, I have a contract in place. So I can't, you know, it can't just all of a sudden go close. And I know many, many birth moms, so that happens to them. They have an open adoption, they have contact, and then one day it just stops. And you don't have any rights because you're a birth mom, and, you know, you sign your rights away, which is such a traumatic thing. And I'll tell you, Greg, I feel like I'm being so down on adoption today. And every day is different for me. I had to have a call with my son's mom recently, and I just, because my mind had completely shifted, and I hated adoption that week. I hated it. And I had to explain to her that, listen, like, the life of a birth mother and the emotional roller coaster, like, sometimes I hate adoption, sometimes I love it. It just, like, you know, it's ever-changing. So I feel like I'm being really, I'm in one of those seasons right now where I really, really hate adoption.
Mm-hmm. Where you're maybe, for whatever reason, acutely aware of the hurts. And at one point in your book, you say, when it comes to giving birth to a baby and then giving it up for adoption, this hurts, let it. I mean, that's your advice. In other words, to not sort of evade the pain or try to run away from the pain, but let it hurt, because in a sense it should hurt. I mean, it is natural for this to be a painful experience. And in a sense, something would be really wrong if there wasn't some pain and hurt wrapped up in it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, people just expect you to get over it and to move on. And, you know, especially when, you know, I made this choice. I always have to remind myself, like, you know, it's okay to feel pain about a choice you made, right? Like, it's okay to let yourself be angry and hurt and sad and depressed at times because of a choice you made. And I think that's the big thing. It's not like this was done to me. I had to consciously sign paperwork to say that this was a decision I was going to make. I had to do that. And to live with that pain, it's really, really, really hard because you know that pain comes from a choice you made, a conscious decision that you made to terminate your legal rights, to place your son in another woman's arms to be his mother. And I think that, you know, I for so long just, I thought something was wrong with me because I couldn't get over it. I couldn't function. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't do anything without just being so sad. And it's hard to find people who get that. It's hard to find even therapists who understand that pain and that trauma because it's not like, you know, I don't want to equate it to this, but when you lose a child, when a child dies, and you lose your child, like, you know that happened. But when you place a child for adoption, like, they're just existing in a world without you. And you don't, you know, and you don't get to be a part of that every day. And it's just, gosh, it's so painful and it's so traumatic. And I just feel really grateful and lucky that, you know, I'm 7 years in. And I found peace with my decision. And I found people who could support me and help me. There are women who are 40, 50 years in, and they still haven't found that. And I feel genuinely incredibly lucky to have found a support system and found a way to find the light and to be happy again. You know, I feel incredibly lucky that that happened for me so early because, like I said, I meet birth moms on a regular basis who are 40 years out, and they're still every day struggling, and they can't breathe. They haven't took a breath since they placed their child because they just haven't gotten the support they need to process and to heal.
Right. I think your book is such an important story, not only about you as the birth mother having given up a child for adoption, but it's also to a large extent about your son's mother and the adoptive mother. And what she has been like, what your relationship has been like, and in many ways it is a remarkably positive story. And in some ways, she seems like something of a role model in terms of being sensitive, and appreciative, and so on. And so I appreciate that the story, in a sense, is very much about both of you. And I was struck over and over again as I read those words, "My son's mother." You writing those words, "my son's mother." When you think about those three words, in some ways at a glance, they don't make sense. My son's mother. And you're talking about somebody who isn't you, somebody else who is your son's mother. In some ways, that's kind of the heart of the matter, isn't it? Coming to terms with sort of the strange enigma that is part of this. And that's really what your book's about.
Yeah, I mean, I think I get a lot of questions about that because I don't call her his adoptive mom, or I don't do that because she is his mom. I'm his mom too, but, you know, she's his mom, and I don't want him to ever think of her of anything other than that, you know? So, and that, I do get a lot of questions on that. And even from other birth mothers, you know, it's hard for them to associate their child's adoptive mom. It's hard for them to say anything other than adoptive mom because it's painful, right? My child calls another woman mom. He doesn't even call me mom. You know, he doesn't call me mom. He calls me Hopi. And that's a hard thing to swallow sometimes. But, you know, she is his mom, and I never want it to be seen as anything other than that.
Hmm. One thing, this is we just have a minute or so for this. At one point early in the book, in talking about how you've come through the most difficult days of this, and although you have bad days and bad weeks, for the most part at least, life is really, really good, really full for you, and that you are blooming now. Why did you use that word, blooming, to describe the way you at least generally feel about yourself and your life at this point?
I think that there was a time where I didn't see a way out of the way I was living. And I believe a lot of people going through things, right, whether they're a birth mother or not, feel the same way. You don't see a light at the end of the tunnel. You don't know how you're going to put your shoes on the next day and be okay. And, you know, I turned a corner. I pulled myself out of a really dark place. Not by myself, of course. There was plenty of support around. But to live the life I do now, I mean, I'm very happy in my career. I obviously wrote a book. I have, you know, I bought a home. I've got a beautiful dog. Like, to live the life that I'm living now, it's sometimes I have to pinch myself because sometimes I can't understand how I came from being, you know, shaking on the floor, thinking I was going to die to all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, it took a lot of work, but just in this different place, in this happy place. And I think that, you know, that's a gift and I don't take it lightly. And I like to celebrate my successes because they're important. Like, getting a promotion at work isn't just a promotion to me. It's, wow, like, I did this. I came from this dark, hellish place, and now I'm here. And even little things, like, I just celebrate everything, and I think every little thing that happens in my life and in other people's life is so important. Little things matter to me, and I think that that is really just, you know, blooming.
The book again is Finding Hope, A Birth Mother's Journey into the Light, published by Lioncrest, the author Hope O. Baker. Hope O. Baker, thank you so much for sharing this honest and illuminating book with the world, and thank you for being part of the morning show today. I'm really glad we got to talk.
Thank you so much, Greg. Happy to be here.
Coming up tomorrow on the morning show, we're going to be talking with Jamie Thompson, an award-winning journalist, about a very, very important book called Standoff, Race, Policing, and a Deadly Assault That Gripped a Nation. This book is Jamie Thompson's detailed chronicle of what ensued in downtown Dallas, Texas, on a July night back in 2016. At a Black Lives Matter demonstration, when a troubled young man, a lone gunman, opened fire and actually killed five members of the Dallas Police Department. Jamie Thompson speaks to a number of people who were on the scene that night, including members of the general public as well as members of the Dallas Police Force. It is a nuanced and illuminating look at one of the most vexing issues facing the United States right now. A marvelous book, and you hear my conversation with its author, Jamie Thompson, tomorrow. On Thursday, we speak with a gentleman who was the media consultant for Jimmy Carter, both when he was running for president and during the first couple years of his time as president. And on Friday, we talk about the challenges of doing choral music safely during COVID-19. I'll be speaking with the directors of choral music at both Carthage College and the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information at carthage.edu. We're approaching 9 o'clock.